The views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us Professor Arthur Burkstahler this evening, who's Professor Emeritus of Chemistry at the University of Kansas, and we're going to be talking about the fluoride, water fluoridation, and the effect of this chemical, really very, very active chemical, on so many aspects of our life. Professor Burkstahler, are you there this evening?
Yes, I am.
Thank you so very much for being with us. I know it's a little late back there, but I appreciate it. I wanted to get your story out to our listeners tonight. And, of course, you've been publishing or editing the journal Fluoride for how many years now?
Well, I've been associated with it since its beginning in 1968 as an assistant editor and helping that sort of thing, and became the editor-in-chief in 1999 when the late John Colquhoun of New Zealand had to retire. He was the former chief dental officer of Auckland and a promoter of fluoridation until he looked into it, and he went over to the other side in 1980, and from about 1991 to 1998 he was editor of the journal Fluoride.
All right, fine. So you've certainly been with it for a long period of time. Now, there's been sort of an organized effort to keep this the journal off of PubMed, up on the journal, up on the Internet.
Yeah, the National Library of Medicine publishes sort of an index or listing of research papers and related to medical subjects. And our journal has been excluded from Index Medicus from its inception, and apparently the bodies that make recommendations, like the American Medical Association, the Dental Association, public health groups, have felt it's a journal that's opposed to fluoridation, and for that reason they would not want to have it listed. On the other hand, Excerpt America in Europe and also Chemical Abstracts in the United States have covered it from the beginning, and so it is getting pretty good coverage, and now Chemical Abstracts has what they call the Science Citation Index, or iFinder Index, which covers all the research papers published in PubMed listings, and as well as their own things in Chemical Abstracts. So we're getting the international coverage finally in the last few years that we didn't get before.
Well, you know, of course, the thing that's really bothersome is other people who come out and oppose fluoridation, like Dr. William Marcus, who is a senior scientist on the drinking water division of the EPA, when he came out and tried to expose the fact that somebody had altered the report prepared for Congress on the carcinogenic effect of fluoride. Why he was fired when he objected to that.
And right.
Phyllis Mullinex, who had done a work on, of course, the effect on the brain in rats, and had a study, I think, 3,000 rats, something like that. And when she published a report pointing out the terrible effects of fluoride in the brain of unborn and newborn rats, why she was fired. And I'm sure you know Dr. Hardy Limebach, up there in Toronto, and he's a professor, but he was threatened. He told me he couldn't come on my programs because, of course, he'd been threatened if he came out and publicly opposed water fluoridation. So, I mean, how can you have an open discussion when you have threats being used to silence the opposition? We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Professor Arthur Burkstahler. Burkstahler, tell it, why is there so much opposition to getting both sides of this issue discussed publicly?
Why won't both sides want to get together to discuss?
Why does the other side, in other words, the people who support water fluoridation...
The opponents would like very much to bring all the evidence out into the open, but the proponents who support fluoridation, I think, find it embarrassing to see so many facts, even from their own journals, contradicting their position of safety and effectiveness. It's very sad to see this happening because it's labeled as a scientific subject by the proponents, and yet they won't treat it as a scientific subject when it comes to the scientific evidence and the discussions. The EPA tried to set up a debate a couple years ago, and the proponents refused to participate. Now, that's the Environmental Protection Agency, of the United States government, and they could not get proponents from even the Public Health Service and the Centers for Disease Control to participate.
Well, if they have nothing, you know, if they really believe in their position, you would think that they would want to bring it out publicly. But really what bothers me really is the fact that I don't think this thing is being presented fairly, and I believe that the water fluoridation is doing terrible things to the health of the American people.
Well, certainly there's a great deal of evidence to support that interpretation. I began to notice it myself in the 1960s with ill effects in my own health that reversed when I stopped drinking fluoridated water, and I know this is true of many other people. And after studying the literature carefully over the years, I'm convinced that the amount of harm it's doing is very great, and the amount of benefit for reducing tooth decay is really marginal and minimal.
Well, now, of course, one of the things that it does, doesn't it have a profound impact on the thyroid, one of the major glands that determines our metabolism?
The thyroid gland is very sensitive to fluoride, and it controls many things in our body. The tiredness that I felt was certainly due to suppression of my thyroid activity, and when I stopped drinking and using fluoridated water, the thyroid function fortunately came back. But if it's affected early stages of life, that may not be so helpful, because the other effects that take place, damaging the brain development and changing a great deal about the body metabolism, those things wouldn't be so reversible if they are affected in the early stages of life.
All right, well, we're going to just wait just a moment until we have our other stations joining us. Our guest this evening is Dr. Arthur Bergstaller. Dr. Albert Bergstaller.
Right.
He's a professor of chemistry emeritus at the University of Kansas. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Professor Emeritus, who's retired, but I understand that he's still goes to work on a regular basis. Are you still up there at the university quite a bit of the time?
Yes, I go up there every day. I'm very busy editing the journal, and I have other research I'm doing. I was very happy to come to Kansas in 1956. I had been a postdoc at the University of Wisconsin and previously in England, and I was graduated from Harvard in 1953. So I feel I've had a very fine scientific training, and it's been a shock to me to see this sort of thing happening with fluoridation. I just couldn't believe the scientific community would turn its back on the evidence the way it has on fluoridation.
But is it really the whole scientific community, or is it just certain people?
Well, no, it's not the whole scientific community, but it's the mainstream of science in terms of the AAA, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, their officers. And generally speaking, I think you'll find many chemists even are skeptical of the evidence against fluoridation because of the training they've had in their textbooks and schooling. When they do take the trouble to look into the literature, I think they certainly come around to seeing the problems. The American Chemical Society on the whole has been quite balanced in its approach to this, and they've had a very good report on the developments of one you mentioned with Dr. Marcus and the problems of tooth decay not being reduced by fluoridation, the review of Chris Bryson's book, Fluoride Deception, and even our book, Fluoridation, The Great Dilemma, published some years ago. Dr. George Walbot and my colleague Lewis McKinney were co-authors of that book, and that got some favorable notice from the American Chemical Society.
Is that book still available?
Well, to a certain extent. It's in libraries, and there are a few copies around that can be obtained. Many people think it's still a pretty good book, and it's out of date, of course. It's 26 years old, but it's a lot of solid evidence there and a great deal about the history and development of fluoridation that balances out what you see in Chris Bryson's The Fluoride Deception book.
Well, let's get started at the very beginning. Is there any evidence that water fluoridation influences fertility, either of the male or the female component of reproduction?
Well, that's an uncertain point right now. We do have the work that shows that when the fluoride levels are around 3 to 4 parts per million, there is a decrease in human fertility. And below that, it's a little bit uncertain. On the other hand, the animal studies, the laboratory studies, are very definite, causing problems with the male fertility. And these studies, I think, are quite clear. But the question is at what level and at what length of exposure, and we're going to see much of that with the human population.
Well, what about
people in good health will have less problems than people with marginal nutrition, for example.
What about the testosterone level or a sperm motility? Has there been any scientific studies?
Well, I don't think at one part per million we can prove much, but certainly a little bit above that there is. And I just don't feel like there's enough evidence to be solid about fluoridation per se on that.
All right. What about Down syndrome?
Well, that's something I did a study on myself, actually. Quickly, the connection of Down syndrome with fluoride in water was first discovered in around the 1955-56 period by a man named Lionel Rappaport, who was an endocrinologist working at the University of Wisconsin. And his studies in the Midwestern states, and particularly Illinois, showed that there was a considerably higher level of Down syndrome births among younger mothers in fluoride, natural fluoride areas of Illinois. And he then did quite a bit of further work, but that's been, in a sense, confirmed, but not directly, by studies from the CDC in Atlanta and my own studies in the state of Michigan show there's probably about a 10 to 15% higher incidence of Down syndrome, that is, the among younger mothers than in non-low fluoride areas. Down syndrome, is, of course, is a type of a mongoloid low IQ problem with trisomy 21.
All right. Well, Chris, we talk about, you know, one part per million of fluoride, but then aren't we getting fluoride from many other sources besides our drinking water? In other words, isn't it actually present in many of the foods that we eat, many of the vegetables that have it sprayed on, certain things that we drink? Would it be, are there other sources besides simply drinking water?
Well, there certainly are, and the fluoride in the food is increased because of food processing with fluoridated water, particularly beverages and juices and certain types of canned goods and so on have increased fluoride because fluoridated water is used in their processing. Without using fluoridated water, many of them would be much lower. But in fact, we're probably getting 2 or so milligrams a day of fluoride on average from food apart from water. But the fluoride in water is absorbed much more efficiently, and there's less protective effect for fluoride in water because we have the things in the food that tend to mitigate the fluoride toxicity to some extent.
All right, so we'd be getting about 2 milligrams a day then of fluoride. Now, is that a toxic dose, or is that a tolerable?
Well, for sensitive people, it would be. There are people who have a very high sensitivity to fluoride illness, and they're a small portion of the population, but they're nevertheless ill affected by as much as 2 or 3 milligrams a day. But usually, around 4 to 5 milligrams a day intake is enough to start the depression of thyroid function for an adult. When it gets into that 4 to 5 milligram range, you're going to see many people suffering effects of lower thyroid function.
Well, now, I've heard that it will not only produce hypothyroidism, sometimes it'll produce hyperthyroidism. Is there any truth to that?
Well, that's true. Usually fluoride is used to reduce hyperthyroid, make it lower in activity. But it can work the other way, too, for certain situations. I'm not as familiar with that as I am with the depression of thyroid function, and it was even used clinically for that purpose some years ago. But it's very risky because you can get over a suppression of thyroid function and then compensation effects, and then they can get the other way.
Well, now, of course, what happens? Does the fluoride then compete with iodine to be taken up by the thyroid?
Well, I think it probably affects the enzymes that are the action of, for the thyroid hormones, the conversion of T4 to T3, the active thyroid hormone, and the thyroid-stimulating hormone. These are the effects that fluoride would have, and I think as far as replacing iodine, that's not as likely as it is suppressing the hormonal activities.
All right, so then it's a cytotoxic effect. In other words, it's
right.
You think it's poisoning the cells that manufacture the thyroid.
Yes.
Well, what about the, certainly when we talk about water fluoridation, are we talking about putting sodium fluoride in, or are we talking about using this hydrofluorosalicylic acid, or salicylic acid?
Well, actually, you're right. Originally, sodium fluoride was promoted as a fluoridating agent, but it's much too expensive to go and use on a large scale, and also the company that was selling it, the aluminum companies, find that they needed to make their own cryolite for their aluminum operations. But It's a waste product now from the phosphate fertilizer industry. The rock phosphate is treated with hot sulfuric acid and liberates some hydrofluoric acid or hydrogen fluoride and silicon tetrafluoride, which form the hydrofluosilicic acid, as a byproduct from that operation. And that is not a small amount, even though the calcium fluoride that's present that produces it is only 2 to 4% of the content of the rock phosphate. It's necessary to convert the rock phosphate to a more soluble form, and that's done with the acid. And the waste product, the hydrofluosilicic acid, is sometimes neutralized and turned into sodium silico fluoride, which are used for water fluoridation purposes. What's the problem there is that the hydrofluosilicic acid and the silico fluorides in the water don't behave quite like even sodium fluoride or the natural fluoride components, because that fluoride sticks quite tightly to some of the silicon. And what you're getting in the body and the stomach then is a silico fluoride combination or complex. And that has different properties, and it's been shown in biological systems in recent studies to be more toxic at the same molar level as the fluoride, sodium fluoride would be.
Well, are there other products in there? Some people say there's lead, cadmium, and
that's correct. There are those toxic byproducts that remain in the bulk commercial hydrofluosilicic acid, and it's not clear to what extent they are present, because you cannot get a good analysis from the companies, and they've ranged very widely, high and low. The sodium salt would be a little less likely to have those contaminants, because it's going to be collected by precipitation, and then the impurities would tend to remain behind. But arsenic and lead and cadmium are three components of the hydrofluosilicic acid which could have toxic potential.
But this is what they're putting in the drinking water?
Well, that's what started back in the 1950s as a more economical way of doing it, and of course the companies that sell it as a byproduct are making a double profit. They don't have to dispose of it as a waste product, so they can sell it and make money on it, as well as the selling of the fertilizer. So it's been a pretty good deal for the phosphate fertilizer companies.
But of course we're always so concerned about the lead and its toxic effect on,
that's right,
on
and
the brain.
There is evidence that the fluosilicic acid fluoridation does lead to higher lead levels in children. We're not sure it's from leaching from the pipes or from the what's present in the fluosilicic acid, but that is a fact, and it doesn't take very much lead to cause lowering of the IQ in children. On the other hand, we have evidence that fluoride alone will lower the IQ, even in the presence of adequate iodine in the diet.
So the minds then of our children really are in jeopardy when we're using these.
Well, certainly from the evidence that's piling up, that's the case, yes.
But shouldn't we know that it's perfectly safe before we give it to countless millions of children?
One would think so, but these thoughts about disturbances of the neurological system were not even envisioned when fluoridation was started. It was only thought in terms of teeth and bones.
Well, of course, you can't put a mineral in just teeth and bones. It involves the entire body. Everything we take in certainly goes to all of our soft tissues.
Well, and certainly the knowledge about fluoride and its effect on enzymes has been well known even before fluoridation was started. Lipase, esterases are very sensitive to fluoride, and this has been well known. So the disturbances of enzyme function, which are critical to the body, we're known even in advance of any effects on teeth or bones.
We'll be back in just a moment with our special guest this evening. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Professor Albert Burgstaller, and we're talking about the effect of fluoride on our children, the effect of fluoride on the people drinking fluoridated water, and it's not simply just fluoride in there. There's arsenic and lead and cadmium and something called, is that polonium, some sort of a radioactive breakdown product that goes on into, what is that?
Well, there is some uranium material in the rock phosphate, and it depends on where it's mined and how much is actually going to get into the fluosilicic acid, because what we're taking is a volatile gaseous product, and that's what's converted to the hydrofluosilicic acid. So those things are carried along to some extent in the vapors, and it'll vary with one place or another of the operations.
So it really depends on which lot of the phosphate byproduct.
Well, I think the processes and the amount of recycling of the scrub waters and so forth, it's a very complicated picture unless you know exactly what's going on at a given location. They've tried in Europe to get detailed analytical data on the hydrofluorosilicic acid being sold to England and Ireland, and they cannot get it, even though these things are manufactured in places like Holland and Belgium where they're not even using it. It's a strange business.
Well, of course, now, my understanding that most of England is not fluoridated. Do we have any idea how much of England is fluoridated?
It's roughly estimated to be around 10%, and there's a lot of push and effort to increase fluoridation in England, but the resistance has been growing quite strong, and the studies in Birmingham, places that have been fluoridated, have not been too favorable for benefits. And same way with Ireland, where they've got about maybe 65-70% of the country fluoridated. Results are not looking very favorable. The tooth decay rates in Ireland are as bad or worse as they are in any other countries. In fact, they're worse than most of Europe. So that doesn't prove that fluoridation has much benefit. Only about six countries in the world are fairly heavily fluoridated: United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and Ireland, and then small places like Singapore. But I think that public health officials in countries that have looked into it more closely, in various parts of Europe that have abandoned fluoridation, do not see it as that much of a benefit or gain. And then, of course, you got the problem of how does fluoride supposedly help the teeth? It was originally thought that incorporating the fluoride into the enamel during the tooth formation and development was critical, and now it turns out that is a very minimal thing, if any, because the teeth with as much or more fluoride are just susceptible to tooth decay as teeth with less fluoride. So the argument now is, well, it's the topical effect of the promoting remineralization of the teeth at the surface in the mouth. But even that is a very weak argument, because there must be enough calcium and phosphate in the saliva to make that work. And that is the problem with so many diets today, that there just is not enough nutrient to do that, to maintain the dental health that should be there with or without fluoride.
Well, my understanding is that the children that drink fluoridated water, their dentition is somewhat delayed. Is that true?
Yes, well, that's a thyroid effect for many cases. It will delay the eruption of the teeth, and this, of course, means you've got a problem in looking at comparisons of younger children, tooth decay versus chronological age of the child versus the age of the tooth. And if you're comparing teeth of different ages, fluoridated and non-fluoridated groups, you're not going to have the right kind of a scientific comparison. My feeling is that when you look at the big studies that have done, the United States Public Health Service study a few years ago with 39,000 children.
Hold that thought for just a moment. We've got to bring our other stations right back with us. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Professor Burgstaller is talking about the large studies that have been done on water fluoridation. He's saying that there is a very, very large study done in the United States comparing fluoridated from non-fluoridated areas. Would you like to pick that story up there?
Well, quickly, it was published around, the preliminary public parts of it around 1990, and there's 84 communities in the United States representing 39,000 children from ages about 5 through 17. And the net picture of it is that the cities with fluoridation versus non-fluoridation or partial fluoridation had essentially the same tooth decay rates. There just was not a statistical difference among them. And independently, that study was confirmed in the state of Missouri about the same time, where they looked at around 6,500 children in the grades 2 and 6, and they saw that the optimal and suboptimal fluoride areas, that is, cities with 7/10 part per million or more versus those with less than that, had essentially the same rates of tooth decay and decay-free teeth. So those are large studies that have more meaning than a small select community compared with another selected community where you don't know whether the selection basis was comparable in the first place. That's been a problem with so much of the fluoridation work. They're looking at individual communities, and when they start looking at a whole region, then it turns out that the fluoride didn't look like it did any good at all. That was particularly true in New Zealand, in a large study of cities in the South Island area. It's been shown to be the same case in Australia, parts of Canada. So when we are comparing a whole group of cities collectively, statistically, There's not much benefit seen with fluoridation.
Well, now, did they do away with fluoridation in New Zealand, or are they still fluoridating?
Oh, they're still fluoridating and still pushing it, same way in Australia. The efforts to get debates over there recently have just been absolutely a failure. The proponents maintain it's safe and good, and they don't think there's any point in debating it because they say the junk science is opposing fluoridation. And yet their own journals, which they're now I have to call junk science to say this, are admitting that there is not that much benefit.
Well, I really think that this is really one of the greatest tragedies of modern time because, of course, we, at least from the studies that you've published over in China as far as the impact on the intelligence, would you like to discuss those Chinese studies that showed that there was a drop in the IQ in the areas that were heavily fluoridated?
Well, actually, they're not fluoridated artificially,
no,
but naturally.
Naturally, right.
Yeah, and China has had a very big awakening, you might say, over the last 10, 20 years about the fluoride toxicity. They recognize it now from the coal burning with high fluoride getting into food and so forth, and waterborne fluoride, of course, in some of the villages has been a big problem, even leading to severe arthritis, bone crippling disease, and so on. But in some of these cities, the villages with only 2 or 3 tenths of a part per million versus 3 or 4 parts per million fluoride in the water, some remarkable differences have showed up, and these have been confirmed as about a 10-point lowering of IQ for the high fluoride cities and compared to the low fluoride ones. And criticism of these studies was, well, maybe lead is causing it. Well, they found the lead levels are the same. Well, maybe it's iodine deficiency. Well, the iodine deficiencies were not a problem. So they pinned it pretty well down to the fact that fluoride from birth or conception through early childhood definitely slows down the learning ability, and these children with many different IQ tests have shown lower IQ in the villages with 3 or 4 or even less, about 2.5 parts per million fluoride in some cases compared to about 2 or 3 tenths.
All right, so then there's not just one, aren't there? Several studies that
that's
demonstrate
right. There are
that?
About 5 altogether now, and we first published one of these in 1996, and there have been several others, and Dr. Zhang has been pursuing this very vigorously, and there's another professor over in Shaanxi University by the name of Xundong Wang, who's been looking at it from the standpoint of animal studies, and he's confirmed much of the work of Dr. Mullinex. So it's all coming together that if you do good scientific work, it should be reproducible, and no matter where you do it, as long as you're getting the same conditions and so forth.
Would you like to just mention Dr. Mullinex's work? Because I think this was leading the way the scientific studies of the impact on the rats' brains and on the activities of the offspring of rats that were fed fluoridated water. Would you like to just cover that briefly?
Well, I might be a little vague in remembering details, but I know that she and Dr. Dan Beston were asked to work on fluoride as a possible toxic study, and they were not expecting to see anything particularly wrong, but they had developed a very sensitive computer program recognition dealing with the positions and activities of the rats could be compared very quickly on a one-second basis, and they saw that the rats were reforming quite differently when they were exposed to fluoride. If they were prenatal exposures, I remember it was a tendency for hypoactivity, lowered response time, and this not as alert, and then certain postnatal exposure at certain periods caused greater effects in males than in females.
Hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we hate to keep interrupting, but unfortunately the computer does that. I don't. But anyway, of course, our guest this evening is Dr. Albert Burgstahler, Professor Burgstahler, Professor Emeritus of Chemistry at the University of Kansas. And we're talking about the studies were done by Phyllis Mullinex, and of course, when she published these studies showing that there really was an effect on the activity patterns of rats, children of the rats born, fetuses born, to mothers that were fed fluoridated water responded in one way. If they were given the fluoridated water after birth, why they responded in an entirely different way.
Some of these effects were like a radiation damage, so that was another point that came. You look at her papers and she sees close parallels. By the way, Dr. Mullinex was a graduate of the University of Kansas Medical Center in toxicology. So I have a strong affinity for her work since I'm also at the University of Kansas.
All right, fine. Now, my understanding is that there have been studies that actually, after feeding the animals of fluoride, they actually found lesions in the brain. Was there a kidney, something of the sort?
Yes, there are definitely abnormalities in the cells of the brain and kidneys and liver. Of course, all of these depend on length of exposure and dosages and so on. But the dosages that Dr. Mullinex was using tried to parallel what we'd have in the human serum with, same thing, about 5 milligrams of fluoride per day ingestion. So she was not far off base as far as the chronic aspect of the toxicity. The complaint has been that she was using simply highly acute levels, and that is not true. And the work in China has backed up the fact that even the chronic levels are showing the disturbances.
So the definite physiological response to the fluoride that we're giving the animals, and then, of course, we can transpose that over into the human being.
Right. And, of course, remember, too, that a lot depends on the state of nutrition for human response. When people are in a good state of health and good nutrition, they're going to be able to resist and hold off the fluoride toxicity a great deal more. But there comes a point with many people where the limit is reached, and there are going to be certain points where the effects are going to be felt, sometimes rather suddenly, and this comes as a shock to people who will be sensitive to something that they weren't sensitive to before.
And so there are many other pharmacological or physiological responses and reactions to fluoride, and we're going to be talking about those as soon as we get our other stations on board. But there seems to be some evidence that there is a carcinogenic influence that this can actually lead to cancers, at least in animals, and we'll see about human beings in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Professor Albert Bergstaller. And, of course, he is a professor emeritus of chemistry at the University of Kansas. And if you're out there in the listening audience and you have a question or comment, give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 464-8295. What about the studies that have been done to suggest that there is a carcinogenic effect of water fluoridation or of excess exposure to fluoride?
Well, that again is one of these complicated subjects where you've got evidence on both sides. I've looked into this rather carefully myself, and I think that there's pretty good evidence that the effects on the bone for young males, osteosarcoma, as they called it, and that's paralleled by animal studies, is quite real. And this was particularly found out in the state of New Jersey when the health officer there, Dr. Cohen, discovered that the fluoridated cities had about double the bone cancer rate in young men as they did in the non-fluoride cities, and a much smaller difference for females. There's also some evidence that esophageal or throat-type cancer may be increased with fluoridation. The other types we're not so sure about, but the overall death rate among older people seems to be higher in fluoridated than non-fluoridated areas. But there again, the statistics are a little bit tricky because of the growth patterns of the cities that were compared. I'm not totally convinced that we can demonstrate things like that epidemiologically as clearly as we would like to, because if the differences are 5 or 10%, then you've got many confounding factors and demographic changes that make the whole interpretation quite complicated. So I would not go on too far on a limb on the cancer aspect, except that the animal studies have shown pretty well that there is a osteosarcoma and a certain types of liver effects and esophageal cancer that can be correlated with fluoride.
Well, now, what about the impact on bones? Because this is one of the things that intrigued me as an orthopedic surgeon, and the relationship between the water fluoridation and hip fractures in both elderly women and elderly men.
Yes, I think those studies look a little better. There are about 20 or 25 out there now, and over half of them indicate a correlation between fluoridation and hip fractures. And a study that we published in our journal a few years ago from Mexico showed that where there was more dental fluorosis, there was also more non-trauma bone fracture occurring among both children and adults, so that the bone fragility was increased with dental fluorosis, which is interesting. And, of course, that ties in with your hip fracture problem. The more the bones are weakened, the more susceptible to a hip fracture.
Well, does this actually weaken the bone? Does it make it more brittle? Does it make it soft?
Well, it can be a brittleness that makes the bone weaker, because you've got to have some flexibility to keep a bone from breaking. And the brittleness that may be caused with fluoride, or just thinning of the bone, making it weaker. Fluoride can cause both an
Porosis?
Fluorosis, kind of a sclerosis or a heavy growth, more extramineralization, but doesn't make it necessarily stronger. Or it can be an osteoporosis, a bone thinning effect, which would make the bone weaker. So it can work both ways, depending on a lot of factors and the hormones and working in the body and so on. But I think the correlations you mentioned about the older people having a greater susceptibility to hip fractures is pretty good work that was published a few years ago from the state of Utah.
All right, and Chris, I remember there were a number of articles published in the Journal of the American Medical Association.
That's right.
That, you know, certainly this is an establishment publication, and yet they're pointing out the relationship between water fluoridation and hip fractures.
Well, that's where it appeared, and it's been sort of set aside and ignored, but the data from other countries is very suspicious, too. I remember talking to some people in New Zealand about the problem of increased hip fractures there, parallel with their increase of fluoridation beginning in the 60s. So, you know, it's a problem because other things are going on too. It's just like tooth decay. They say, well, tooth decay came down because of fluoridation, but during that same period we had much better dental nutrition from the standpoint of the food quality and the restoration of nutrients and minerals and food, baby foods. And so that factor has to be taken into account against fluoridation.
Well, certainly in Europe, where almost none of the major countries, other than perhaps England, and Ireland, are fluoridating their water. Do they have, haven't they had a dramatic fall in the incidence of dental caries?
That's right. Their tooth decay rates have declined over the past 25 years as much or more than in the United States. And all they've had is some fluoridated dentifrices, which they claim may have been a benefit. But I think, as in the United States, there have been a great deal of improvement in infant and child dental nutrition. The quality of the baby foods and the attitudes toward feeding children when they're young, dental care, all that's been improved. But in the poorer communities, the inner cities in the United States, we've got a lot more tooth decay even with fluoridation because those factors are not taken care of as much.
Well, now, my understanding is that there have been moves by the American Pediatric Association and by the American Dental Association to say that children less than 6 months of age should not be getting any fluoride.
That's right. They've come to that conclusion now because there's already so much in their diets. I might mention about Europe, the places that have stopped fluoridation in Finland and Holland or Germany did not see any increases in tooth decay in those communities after fluoridation was stopped for the next 5 or 10 years. So that's an important point to consider, too.
Well, you know, I talked to a gentleman today, and he told me that his grandson is 3 months old, and the pediatrician is giving, them vitamins with fluoride in them, you know. Of course, apparently this is the way they've done it in the past, and irrespective of the fact that the American Academy of Pediatrics and the ADA has come out against that, I don't think most doctors really realize that they've changed their position, and they've really rather dramatically saying...
I think you're probably right, but there's also another point to it, and I think I mentioned this one time, that the children can have colic and sensitivity. Their stomachs react to that little bit of fluoride. It irritates the stomach as it hits the acidity of the stomach and forms hydrofluoric acid, which is very tissue corrosive and irritating. I have a grandniece in Lansing who whose mother insisted on following the pediatrician's advice and fluoridated vitamins, and I had all this colic problem. My sister, who is a nurse, said, well, Martha, why don't you just get her off the fluoridated vitamins and see what happens? And Martha was just absolutely amazed. The kid became very happy and docile, and all this irritation just disappeared when she simply stopped giving the fluoridated vitamin. Now, that's a very real situation, which I'm sure many parents and children would be very happy to know about.
But I don't think they know about it. And, you know, in fact, when I talked to this fellow today, and I just said, well, you know, just tell your daughter to get, you know, stop giving those vitamins. And, you know, the information is available. We'll send it to any of our listeners from the CDC and from the American Academy of Pediatrics saying don't use it before 6 months. And even after that, they have very limited amounts of fluoride up to, what, about 2 or 3 years? What's the...
That's right, maybe a quarter, half a milligram. But that's all based on the idea of fluoride incorporation in the teeth, which has now been shown to be totally fallacious. Getting extra fluoride into the dental enamel does not help resist tooth decay.
What about this policy that they have in so many dental offices where they want to paint fluoride onto the teeth, or they want you to take this big mouthful of this awful green stuff and keep it in your mouth there for 2 or 3 minutes?
Well, the benefit seems to be very marginal at best, and putting an enamel sealant in the crevices of the molars would be more effective than painting all that fluoride. And there have been so many children getting sick from that. That's the thing that should be looked at. It doesn't take much fluoride for a child to develop not only nausea and vomiting, but sometimes even worse case. There have been deaths reported from children suffering from this fluoride treatment in dental offices.
Well, now, what about what about fluoridated toothpaste? Is this a good idea? Do you think we'd be better off to change our toothpaste? Because almost all of the major Colgate, Palmolive toothpaste are fluoridated, and yet they're really toxic doses of fluoride.
That's right. It wouldn't take much for a child to get pretty sick from swallowing some of that toothpaste. Personally, I don't see that it does that much good if you've got a good diet. By a good diet, I mean one that's adequate in intake for calcium and fresh vegetables and things like that. That's where the benefit for the tooth comes in. I might mention that years ago, in the time of the Depression, Weston Price, a very famous dentist, simply took the school luncheons in Cleveland and boosted the calcium intake to about 2 grams a day for serving of stews and things of this sort. And the tooth decay that was among these children reversed itself. He was showing pictures in his book of the tooth actually self-healing, remineralizing, and this was without any extra fluoride. It's simply from the extra calcium that he put in the meals, and the kids were getting 2 or 3 helpings at the noon meal, and he said some of them were getting as much as 2 to 3 grams of calcium, and that's what changed the picture.
Well, does the fluoride act in the mouth at all?
The oral tissue, the mouth sores from fluoridated toothpaste is something that many people have experienced in the past, and perhaps because of the way the compounding of the fluoridated toothpaste. How much that occurs today, I'm not so sure, but we've got cases on record of irritation of the oral tissues from fluoridated toothpaste, yes.
Well, somebody had called in and wanted to know if there was any evidence that there's any relationship between water fluoridation and autism. Is there, or is that more probably related to mercury? Or do we know?
We don't know for sure, but I know there are cases where people have switched their children from fluoridated water and their ability to concentrate and to learn has greatly improved. So it does affect some children's ability for attention span and learning.
Well, I think this really disrupts the whole endocrine system. Doesn't it have some impact upon, or is there any truth to the fact that it results in an early menarche, in other words, the onset of puberty in girls?
Yes, that was pretty well shown in the study in Kingston, Newburg, New York. They found that the girls were starting to menstruate about 5 to 6 months earlier in the fluoridated Newburg than they did in non-fluoridated Kingston. And there have been some other studies on the pineal gland that has an effect in controlling that, animal studies in England. And so it all is tying together that fluoride does affect the thyroid and affects the pineal gland and then the age at which menstruation starts and so on.
All right, well, we have a caller here, and let's see who we have. It's Ed, and Ed is calling from Utica, in New York. Hi, Ed. How are you doing?
Hello. Dr. Stan.
I have a question.
I'm glad that you are pursuing this problem with fluoride.
I think it's a very important problem.
It seems like I've talked with 3 to 4 dentists in the last couple of weeks, and they all seem to be confirmed that fluoride is good for the teeth.
Right.
Well, one thing, though, I suppose that even if it were, which I doubt, I'm wondering what the effect might be. Is we have a potential, in my viewpoint, of terrorism getting into the water supply. It's already set up to add fluoride into the water system. How could is there a possibility of that problem occurring?
Well, there have been some accidents from over-fluoridation recorded, too. And when the pumps break and don't work properly, and there have been some cases where the fluoride levels have gone up to as much as 100 parts per million and caused a lot of illness and sickness in a number of communities. It happened in Alaska and Maryland, a number of places, Michigan. And so the accidents from over-fluoridation would suggest that if someone was determined, they might be able to do something along a terroristic line with fluoride, too.
Well, I think they're probably more efficient means of terrorism.
But
don't spend all your time worrying about terrorism. Remember, it's been over 3 years. We haven't had one single attack in America. Our borders are wide open. Our planes are unprotected. There are very, very few sky marshals there. I think that maybe they're just trying to scare us to death. And they're doing a pretty good job, too. Anything else you'd like to say?
I had understood that fluoride has the potential to reduce the ability for people to think and act. And so that's one of the things that I was concerned about.
Well,
that has been well documented, decrease in mental acuity. We have some cases of this described in the book Fluoridation, The Great Dilemma, where a person was finding that his visual accommodation and his ability to think clearly causing trouble. He couldn't fly his plane and so forth. And when he got off the fluoridated water within a few weeks, the recovery took place very well. So it can be reversible for some of these neurological effects, but you're right. Loss of mental acuity is one of the features that are reported for fluoridation, even apart from an IQ lowering. In other words, a temporary effect rather than a permanent one.
And, of course, this is the active ingredient in Prozac, Luvox, and so many of the psychotropic drugs that we're giving today.
Well, we're not sure how much of that fluoride is being released as a fluoride ion, but the potential of those drugs in relation to fluorine being present is certainly quite real. And they do have a pharmacological effect which is in some ways peculiar and deleterious because they're fluoridated or have fluorine in them.
Anything else, Ed?
That's all that I have right now.
I'm sorry your dentists don't read their own literature very well, because if they did, they'd see that it's not doing much good. A big report from York University with a dental group admitted that fluoridation had very little dental benefit, and they tried to cover it up, but that was a big study of papers from all over the world. It was just published a few years ago. I think if you look closely at the dental literature, you'll see that the benefits are really marginal or negligible.
Ed, we're going to try to put together a syllabus here in the near future, and then you'll be able to take things from the dentist's actually own literature and show it to them and say, hey, did you read this? Are you reading your literature?
That would be great.
Okay, we're working on it. Thanks so much, Ed.
Thank you.
God bless. Okay, fine. That was Ed from Utica, New York. And, of course, we've only got three or four minutes here before we have to let Professor Burgstahler go. Well, of course, you know, the idea that something could influence so many aspects of our life, you know, it could be carcinogenic, could attack our bones, could affect our fertility, certainly could affect our endocrine system, our thyroid. What about this idea of premature aging in certain areas with very, very high levels? I understand that in areas of Turkey and even some of these areas in China.
Yes, it's been seen in China as well, and it certainly seems to be related to the onset of crippling arthritic symptoms and really immobilization, muscle weakness, and so on. I just wanted to add one point is, how in the world does our education system get so fouled up that we get the people going into science following a general party line that it turns to be erroneous and just seems to be so difficult to correct. As a chemist, I see new findings constantly being looked at and accepted and changing old views, but it doesn't seem to happen this way in the field of public health. They get stuck on something and they can't break away from it.
Well, I think when everybody else is thinking the same way, it's a pretty hard job. But all you need to do is just be persistent and come out. And I fought this battle within organized medicine for many years on the AIDS epidemic. After 10 years, I brought the doctors of the California Medical Association around to my point of view. Of course, it didn't do any good because the leadership had their own agenda, and we weren't going to stop the AIDS epidemic. We'll be back in just a moment to wrap up the program. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course our guest this evening has been a Professor Albert Burkstahler, and he's been kind enough to stay up. It's getting a little late back there in Kansas where he is, and we've got about 3 minutes before we have to let him go. Well, certainly my concern really is the effect on the minds of our children, because I was just reading a report comparing American students to academic achievement to students in other countries. And now, I can't say this is all related to fluoride or to mercury or to aspartame and the other things, the other neurotoxins that children seem to be using, but my concern is that our kids are not going to be able to compete in the world. The four-year-olds were bad. The fourth grade was bad. The eighth grade was even worse. And the kids graduating, the children graduating from high school, the article said, comparing with children from the rest of the world, they could not compete. Do you notice this with students in your classes?
It's certainly true in the field of chemistry. We've been very disappointed with all the money and effort, equipment, and so on we put into chemistry teaching, and the high school students are not competing as well as they should. Frankly, I think it's not just the students. I think the product of our textbooks and the training of our teachers is involved, too. And this goes into the schools of journalism. They resist looking at evidence. They want to take the easy path and just take what's there in the book and pass it on, and they're not the inquiring mind that we should have in a good student.
But not only that, if we don't have good students, then America as a nation is not going to be able to compete effectively in a competitive world. This is my concern.
Yeah, well, that shows up in those IQ studies we mentioned. The higher end of IQ, where you're looking for your brighter people to go into science and professional fields and engineering and so forth, that is greatly reduced as a fraction of the total when you've got a 10 or 12 point lowering of IQ. And so we're losing the quality people at the top as well as the average in the middle. Even though the IQ scores look like they haven't changed a lot, those tests have been adjusted in such a way that they're masking the decreases in learning ability. And certainly the failings in math and science are very real.
And of course, compared with the rest of the world, America is down pretty close to the bottom. Well, Professor, thank you so very much for being with us. It's been a real pleasure, and I hope we can have a chance sometime to meet personally.
Thank you.
Good night, and God bless you, sir.
Good night.
Okay, well, that was Professor Albert Burkstahler from the University of Kansas, and of course we've been talking about the effect of fluoride on the minds of our children, and it's a very, very sad, tragic story. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course this is the time when I want to mention some of the items that we have, which I think will help you to better understand the message that we're getting out. Certainly, if you'd like a free copy of our November newsletter, which deals exclusively with the fluoride issue, we'll be glad to send you one, and you just give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927, and specifically ask for the November newsletter. Now, you can also go up onto our website at radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com, all one word, radioliberty.com, and you can pull down the newsletter there, and you're welcome to copy that newsletter and get copies of it out to others and try to get them to read it and understand what we're talking about. The scientific studies are there now. We carry an excellent book. It's called The Fluoride Deception. It's written by Chris Bryson, going into the background of the effort to sell the American people this failed program is a good program. And he goes, of course, into all the politics of this, how this has been distorted, how information has been suppressed, how people have been threatened, and that he is, of course, looking at it purely from a financial point of view. And, of course, I look at it a little bit differently. Many of these people are invested in making money. But I also believe that there really is a spiritual component to what's going on, because this is going, in my estimation, to lead to the eventual destruction of this nation. If you attack and destroy the minds of our youth, how could we possibly survive as a free society? And, of course, it has been known for many years, going back to the time of Adolf Hitler, that water fluoridation can be used to subdue the aggressiveness of people in the occupied areas. That's why in the areas that the Nazis occupied during the Second World War, they fluoridated the water. That's why the Russians fluoridated the water in the concentration camps in Siberia, in the Gulag. Why? Because they knew it would make people pliable. Now, if that indeed is true, and of course if you get my November newsletter, you'll get the references on that, why, then why are they so intent upon fluoridating the water in the United States? We carry another excellent book. It's called Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life. It's by our good friend, Dr. Russell Blaylock. That's Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life. And there's an excellent section, probably 20 or 30 pages, on fluoride. And many of my references that I had in my November newsletter come from Dr. Blaylock's book. So we recommend that book to you. We have actually a four-tape set of interviews with Dr. Blaylock, Health and Nutrition Secrets and Save Your Life, and one tape is pretty much on fluoride, and one is on aspartame, and one is on mercury, and one is just on general nutrition. We think that's a very important tape. Then we have a four-tape set on water fluoridation, and we think it's so vitally important that you understand what this issue is, and then you can go up on the Internet, and there are all sorts of websites you can go to. KeepersOfTheWell.com or org, that's KeepersOfTheWell.com or org, or just go to Google and type in fluoride or water fluoridation, and there are at least a half a dozen excellent websites up there with all sorts of material, and there are articles on the relationship of Down syndrome. What a terrible thing, you know, to be given water fluoridation when you know it increases the incidence of this terrible, terrible tragedy for any family. So what you need to do is begin doing some research up on the Internet. If you need additional original copies of many of these articles from the dental literature, hopefully we're going to have them compiled here before very long and make them available to our listeners. And you need to begin getting to the dentist and say, look, why don't you go up on the Internet and check out the facts? Why don't you question what you've been taught in school? Would you intentionally hurt the mind of a child? And if there are these scientific studies out there, is somebody actually suppressing this information to keep it from being known? Well, remember, our number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Pray for America. Pray for revival. Please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us on the line Dr. Charles McGee, and we're going to be talking about his book, Heart Fraud. And he's had a fascinating life. Dr. McGee, would you like to tell our listeners just a little bit about yourself?
Oh, my. That's I'll try to condense it.
All right, fine.
Well, I practiced obstetrics for 17 years in California, and then I got into alternative medicine, and by 1978, my practice was entirely made up of complementary and alternative approaches, and I did that until I retired in 1996. And along the way, we got into a whole lot of stuff.
Now, what part of the state did you, were you practicing in?
Primarily the East Bay.
Okay, fine. Well, that's, of course, where I was raised, up there at Merritt Hospital. Of course, you were the East Bay, Merritt, Peralta, those...
We were farther out. We were in Walnut Creek and
okay.
Concord.
Okay, fine.
But I trained at Highland in Oakland.
Well, I trained there. I was a senior resident in orthopedics there in my...
When was that?
Oh, that was, let's see, 1960.
Yeah, I was there 61 to 65.
Okay, well, it was a great place
to be. Behind you.
So anyway, of course, you've had a very colorful life, though. You've done a lot of traveling, haven't you?
Yes, quite a bit. We lived in Ecuador for a year and traded Indians in the Andes down there. And we traveled all around South America. Went to Europe 8 or 10, 12 times or so. I can't keep track. Been to China 7 times and was hauled around the country over there and pushed into a high-level energy healing system called Qigong, and wrote a book on that, and went into a lot of things.
All right, now, of course, you have been somewhat interested in the heart and some of the things that are being done in the way of heart surgery. Do you want to sort of develop these ideas?
Yeah, about 1984, I started to do chelation therapy, and I was not seeing heart patients before. And I got this story from so many of them that they got in a hospital, they had angina, they maybe had a small heart attack. And then pretty soon, they're just like steamrolled into having a bypass surgery. The angiogram is done, and they're told they have a widowmaker. Even women are told they have a widowmaker. And they're told they'll be dead the next morning if they don't get the surgery right away. And I was seeing these people that had refused this type of surgery and that were alive 10, 15 years later. And so I looked into it, and I went to the library and I did a lot of reading.
All right, does chelation really work?
I've seen it do some miraculous stuff. It doesn't work all the time. Certainly nothing does. But I had one guy with gangrene in a toe, and that healed up. They were going to cut his leg off. I had another guy on the transplant list in Vancouver, B.C., to get a heart transplant, and we chelated him, and they took him off the list, and he lived another 6 years, and he was very active during those 6 years. And that's about as long as he would have lived if he had the transplant.
All right, fine. So you think the chelation, at least with some of the people, can be beneficial?
It can be very dramatic in some, yes.
What percentage would you say would be worthwhile?
Generally, people that do it claim about 80% of the time it'll work and achieve what it's supposed to be doing, what they want it to do. And 20% of the time, it's like nothing happened.
Okay, and Chris, what does the chelation involve?
It uses a drug called EDTA, which is FDA approved for lead poisoning, and it's given in a drip or as a 1 minute push now, even faster, in a different form.
And well, that's off right now.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. I guess this evening is Charles McGee. And, of course, he's written a book called, is that Heart Fraud? Is that the title?
It's plural, heart frauds.
Heart frauds.
I found several.
Anyway, we were just talking about chelation. And, of course, you had actually given up your OBGYN practice?
Oh, by that time. I gave that up in 1976.
Did you miss it, or did you, of course, it's an awful lot of late work and night work, and then...
I didn't miss that part of it. I didn't miss being up all night, but I just got interested in a whole bunch of other things, and I was buying books, and the stack of books was getting pretty high, and I couldn't read them if I was up at night. I couldn't concentrate. I'd fall asleep. And so I gradually phased over in what I was doing, gave up the OB part and then the GYN part, and then I was sleeping at night, and I could absorb all this stuff, and I changed my diet, and I did a whole bunch of things to change my lifestyle. That was back about the middle 70s, 30 years ago, and I felt a tremendous difference from that. In fact, I had a 240Z at the time, I think a 73 240Z, and I was gaining a little weight. One day I went to sit down in it, and that type of car, usually you sit in, you put your butt in first and sit down, and as I stretched my pants, I tore my seam. And I thought, uh-oh, I better do something. I'm getting too heavy here. And it sort of pushed me into doing some stuff.
All right, so you actually then, of course, changed your whole lifestyle and you changed your practice. And you commented that when you were, of course, dealing with the people in the Andes, they didn't have a lot of the degenerative diseases we have here?
Yeah, there were two patterns there. The people that lived in town had been eating processed and refined food for about 15 to 20 years or so. And they were beginning to see the first heart attacks and diabetics and strokes. And
can you sort of speak up? I'll just you're fading in and out just a little bit.
Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah, the people who lived in town were eating a different diet than the Indians that lived in the countryside. And the people in town were beginning to get a disease pattern like we were experiencing, except they never had it before. And the Indians were still totally free of it. The hospital had, I think, 60 beds in it for 300,000 Indians. And in the whole year we were there, there was one appendicitis. There were no heart attacks, no diabetics, no strokes. They didn't see anybody with high blood pressure, osteoporosis, a long list of diseases.
And so really the diseases we see in our society are entirely different than the diseases you saw there.
Yeah, they were. But then when I looked into it more, I found that that was the pattern that human beings had from the beginning. They were free of those illnesses until the modern diet hit them. And hit them hard. And this was first seen by studies of a dentist in between 1930 and 40 that traveled all around the world trying to find the cause of the tooth decay. And what he found...
Hold that thought right there. We'll bring our other stations right back on. Well, I guess this evening, Dr. Charles McGee, and of course, he has had an interesting life. He had lived a time down in the Andes area. And was that in Peru or in Chile?
That was in Ecuador.
In Ecuador. Mm-hmm. All right. And of course, he found that the Indians did not have the heart attacks and the appendicitis and the osteoporosis and the diabetes and the things that afflict our society. And, of course, the people who lived in the cities there, of course, had lots of them. And then he was talking about how there was a dentist who went all over the world trying to determine the cause of tooth decay and, of course, pick up the story from there.
Yeah, he discovered after several years of doing this that the only place where people were free of tooth decay and had straight teeth were areas where he had to walk in. There was no road. So that meant there was no commerce going back and forth between the area and the outside. And they didn't have a store, they weren't drinking soda pop, they weren't eating candy bars, and they weren't eating white flour crackers or things like that. And you notice they were very robust people and very healthy. As soon as the area became developed a little commercially, then a company would come in, like in Ecuador, it would be United Fruit, would come in and want to develop a banana plantation, so they'd hire the natives to do the labor. They'd poke a road into the area and start developing it, and then immediately start paying them as little as they could get away with, usually, but pennies an hour or so, and they'd open a store. And the only place the natives could spend their money was at the store, and they were selling all these junk food things, refined carbohydrates. And if a woman began to eat that type of diet and then got pregnant, her very next baby, as it grew up, would have a high decay rate, maybe 30 to 50% of the teeth would decay, and the teeth would come in crooked because the jaws would not grow to the full potential because something was interfering with the normal development.
Now, do you think this then would be the carbohydrates of sugar, or what was it be specifically in the diet that is causing these problems?
Well, it was a package of things that came at once, and so you can't pin it down to one thing. Nobody ever had an area where just one of these junk foods came in by itself, so you could pin it on one thing. But in other parts of the world, the same thing happened. This was worked out by a British epidemiologist named Cleve in the 40s and 50s, and he found the same pattern. He never found a single exception to it, but epidemiology stuff is not accepted in medicine. It's sort of, they say, well, that gives you the clue of where to go to study. You can't do a study in this kind of stuff because you can't lock people up for a lifetime and do a study in between how one person eats and another group eats. But I saw the same pattern myself a second time in Hainan Province, which is an island between Hong Kong and Vietnam. And we were visiting at the main hospital there, and I was talking to the chief of the hospital and found that they were not seeing heart attacks or high blood pressure or strokes, the same list. And the people were eating all fresh food because it was sort of left as a backward area that was undeveloped. It used to be part of Canton Province, and all the money they had to develop went into the mainland part and left the island sitting out there doing things the way they always had done.
And what were they doing? Were they eating the fish and just vegetables, things like that?
Well, the amazing thing was, you know, we hear all this thing about the cholesterol diet and high-fat diet, low-fat diet, and all these things. These diets around the world that were successful in primitive cultures were all over the map. But the common factor was they didn't contain the white flour, the white sugar, the white rice, the canned goods, frozen goods, like canned or in packages, boxes, and processed food and things like that. And that was a common factor. So that bugged me for a long time because in some of these areas that the dentist found, very little of the diet changed. It wasn't a huge shift. He probably found some areas where only 10% of the diet became the modern food, and that was enough to do it. So that bothered me a long time until I got off into energy medicine, and I think the explanation may be there, but I don't know how anyone's going to ever prove it. As if something happens energetically to food as it goes through this mechanical industrial processing technique, and it's cooked and boiled and sifted and put into vats that are cleaned out with formaldehyde and other antiseptics, and all sorts of things are done to it.
Well, then, if we were just to eat then fresh fruits and vegetables and really be almost like a vegetarian, would we be far better off physically?
I don't think you have to be a vegetarian. I think the key is to eat a lot of fresh food.
Mm-hmm.
And not to overcook anything. There's some things that you have to cook for safety, but like in my experiences in China, I watched a woman prepare 13 dishes for a dinner, and she cooked them all in one wok and had all the plates on the dinner table at the same time hot. And that wok, the bottom of that wok was red hot from cooking with coal. And that food didn't stay in there hardly at all. So it just got the outside sort of seared or sealed, and then it was out of there and the next dish went through. And they cook everything, but they don't overcook anything except rice.
Okay, and of course, the Chinese are eating the white rice, or are they eating the brown rice?
Well, in the past there wasn't any white rice, and then they switched, there wasn't any white, so they bring that in, and the Chinese liked the white rice because it was cleaner, it stuck together better, it was easier to eat with chopsticks, and so they switched to that, and they did that a long time ago, maybe 80, 90 years ago.
All right, and of course, did they have any deleterious effects from it?
Well, yeah, they're beginning to see the same things we're seeing here, except in this one area down in Hainan where they didn't change all that stuff.
In other words, you think they're a lot more healthier when they eat the brown rice?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. I think so. And I talked to the professors at the leading nutrition institute in Beijing, and I gave my little spiel on this. It's a different talk, and with a movie with it. And they said, we believe everything that you're saying, but we don't know how to stop it.
Well, now, you've been over to China then a number of times as a visiting professor, or what? Are you just going over on your own?
No, I went over 7 times, and 6 of those were being invited over to give some lectures and to do some work with a government official who has a PhD in biomedical engineering.
Now, the Chinese government then support this sort of thing and this sort of research and developing these ideas?
No.
Or is it just local areas?
Well, Hainan was sort of left that way because that's the way everybody used to be, and they'd never changed it. It wasn't an effort to change it into what they had. It's actually just leaving it alone.
All right, well then, what is the basic theme of your book, the health fraud, and what is the basic message that you would like to get to the listeners tonight? Health frauds, I should say.
Yeah, when I...
Heart frauds.
When I started reading and finding out, well, how much backup is there for the bypass, for example, I came to the conclusion at the end of all this that there are many invasive procedures that are being done to heart patients that you can't really justify according to the published literature. And these articles are in the best of medical journals that doctors say they believe, and then but they don't believe them in practice. They don't want to change the way they're doing something just because a journal, medical journal, says it's probably not a good idea.
Well, but of course, certainly, don't some people benefit from getting a cardiac bypass?
Yeah, I think there's some people that have intractable angina, and they work on it, and they can't get any way to get rid of the pain, and the bypass might be the only thing that relieves it. In fact, I had a chelating doctor friend in Yakima that ended up with a bypass.
And he was a doctor who actually used chelation probably on himself?
Yeah, he chelated himself, huh?
And it didn't do any good.
Nothing did any good for him, and he ended up getting a bypass to get rid of the pain.
So this is really, it's an amazing procedure, you know. They're very intricate, and you have to be very, very skilled to be able to do something like that.
True, but three large studies were done to try to see what happened to people who were either, they were randomized into either getting a bypass or medical management. And all three studies went for 10 years after to see what happened to them.
Mm-hmm.
And in all three studies, the survival rate was the same after 10 years, and the quality of lifestyle was the same, and you couldn't see where the bypass made any difference at 10 years.
Now, did they have a comparison of one who had the procedure and one who didn't? Or?
No, there were large groups. Like the first one was a veteran study that came out in New England Journal of Medicine in 1977. It was done in a series of veterans hospitals, and they collected... Oh, I can't remember now, 700 or 800 people, and half of them got a bypass and half got medical management, and then they were followed for 10 years. And I remember the day that journal article came out, because some friends of mine I saw in the hospital, and they were almost whispering to each other that something like, do you hear the latest, the bypass doesn't work. And at the same journal, Eugene Brownwald, who was a professor of medicine at Harvard, wrote an editorial after that article, and he said that he attacked the use of the bypass for indications other than intractable angina and predicted the procedure may develop a life of its own and can't be stopped. And that's exactly what happened. And then two other studies came along. The prima donnas in medicine and heart surgery, like DeBakey and Cooley and probably Shumway, got together and said, oh, they had a 5.6% death rate in that veteran study from the surgery. And they said, we think our patients are doing better than that. After all, what can you expect from, you know, the attitude is sort of looking down on the VA hospital system, which a lot of doctors do. And so they said, well, we're sure that we're getting better results than that. So they set up another study. It was called the CASS study, that ran 10 years, and it got the same result. Didn't get any better results.
Well, now, of course, did they get the same mortality rate? Was the Veterans Administration study mortality rate in the hospital, or was that the mortality rate 10 years down the line?
No, that was the 5% was the mortality rate with the surgery itself.
Right. What about the mortality rate in the large centers, Shumway and Cooley and DeBakey?
Well, it turned out to be the same at that time in the other study.
It really did.
Yeah, but the long-term thing was what they're looking at, and at 10 or 11 years, the patients weren't any better with the bypass.
Okay, we're going to be back. I thought the mortality rate was, you know, in a good center was maybe 1 or 2%. Is it really?
Well, it is now. I think it's come down since then. See, this was back in the 70s and 80s.
I see. Okay.
Yeah.
We'll be back here in just a moment or two. Because I can remember before they even started doing heart surgery, when they were doing surgery on dogs trying to learn how to do the heart surgery, that was back in 53, I think, when I was at Merritt Hospital in Oakland. We'll be back here in just a moment. With our special guest, if you have a question, his name is Charles McGee. I have a copy of his book, which my wife just brought me, called Heart Frauds, Uncovering the Biggest Health Scam in History. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Dr. Charles T. McGee. And, of course, he has written a book on health scam and pardon me, on health frauds. And he feels that certainly there's a great deal of excessive surgery being done. What about the angiograms, things of that sort, which are opening up the clogged arteries?
You know, when the angiogram came along, the only studies they did were to compare it to the bypass. They didn't do studies where they compared it to medical management that I could find.
Well, now, of course, when you say medical management, are you talking about a dramatic change in diet? Are you talking about a dramatic change in diet and chelation?
No. I'm talking about what the average cardiologist would recommend they do or do with them and prescribe medication for.
Right.
Not alternatives at all.
All right. So, but basically, if you don't have if you don't not have your angiogram and have a stent or something put in, how would you handle these cases? And what would the incidence of heart attack be if you did nothing?
Well, I'll give you an example. There was a second opinion clinic set up in the Harvard area by Thomas Grayboys, who was a Harvard cardiologist, and some of his friends, and they published two papers in Journal of American Medical Association. And in one study, the people that they were seeing had been advised to have an angiogram, and in the second study, they'd been advised to have the bypass. And in both cases, they evaluated them independently, largely with the echocardiogram, determining what their pumping efficiency was of their heart, and they decided that was the most efficient way of deciding what might happen to them in the future. They advised against the invasive procedures but in 85% of the cases. And then they followed these people that were advised to have a bypass for 2 years, and the death rate in that group of patients per year was 1%, which is pretty good for people with known heart disease.
Okay, what about if they didn't have anything done specifically? Now, were these people who did not have anything done or people who had the bypass or the angiogram?
Well, the 1% death rate was in the group of people who had been advised to have a bypass, and then after their second opinion clinic, they were told they didn't need it.
Okay.
And they didn't have it.
Okay. And so 1% a year is not that bad. Some of the people would lead 99 years. It's at least one guy would.
Mm-hmm.
All right, fine. Well, of course, this is sort of a challenging what most people really believe, that this was the panacea, although my understanding is that since the angiogram came along, why the incidence of the cardiac bypass surgery has really dropped dramatically in hospitals.
I don't think it has. I think what happened was there was almost a feud between the bypass surgeons and the cardiologists who were beginning to pass catheters. And the bypass surgeons were afraid that the patients are going to be cut off at the pass. They're going to get a different procedure, and they won't need the bypass anymore. But both areas mushroomed, and the number of bypasses went up, and the number of angioplasties went up too.
Is that still going on today?
I think so. I don't see any indication that it's begun to drop off.
All right, fine. Well, I know I was going to have some surgery, and. And of course, you go in, and of course, the doctor is trying to protect them. These doctors, personal friends of mine, and of course, you go in, you have your you're supposed to have a stress EKG, but I had a bad hip, so I couldn't have it. So I had some other radioactive studies done, and then they said, "Oh, you got to have another radioactive study." And every time they did it, I thought I was going to die. And then, of course, I had to have the angiogram, and you know, I'm amazed. I had the best looking angiogram I ever saw. But, you know, nothing wrong with me, so I would have had the surgery and no real complications at all. But I'm sure if I could have gotten on that stress EKG, it probably would have been completely normal. But without that, you started getting, you go from step to step to step to step, and the next thing you know, you're in getting your angiogram.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I want to talk about the angiogram, too, because there are two forms of the angiogram. And most doctors don't even know that.
All right, well, let's go ahead. And our guest this evening is Dr. Charles McGee. And he's talking about his book, Heart Frauds. And why don't you talk about the various types of angiograms?
Well, the standard one that's been around longest, they use one camera, and they're taking a two-dimensional picture of a three-dimensional object, the artery, in motion. And they have done several studies to try to determine how accurate this is. They've looked at it many different ways. In one study, four experts at Harvard who teach this to doctors, radiologists, read the same angiograms, the same parts of the same artery,
In one case, one of them said, I don't see any block there at all, and the other one said, I see 100% block. And they were looking at the same thing on the artery, on the x-ray. And this is published in, I don't know where.
Well, now don't we have some of these great two, sort of three-dimensional pictures, though.
Yeah, right. Okay, they also said some radiologists were reading the same angiograms 3 months apart and disagreed with themselves drastically. And the correlation between the angiogram reading and autopsy findings turned out to be very poor. And then in 1977, a fellow at University of Washington came up with a 3D version of the angiogram, but they're it's highly accurate. It's accurate to 1% error, and it's the only version of the angiogram that is acceptable for research work, because doctors know the other ones are not that accurate. And even an article from the Cleveland Clinic said that they felt the ordinary angiogram was so inaccurate that surgical plans should not be based on it. But there are very few of these 3D version angiograms around.
All right, fine. So you feel that the people at least should give serious consideration to, a medical regime before they undertake a surgical procedure. Would that be a fair statement?
Yeah, I always ask myself, what would I do if I got into this trouble? Because I'm getting up there. I'm about 69 now. My dad died of a heart attack. So I've been thinking about this for 40 years since he died. And I would want to be in the hospital. I'd want to get monitored in coronary care unit for arrhythmias and have those corrected if they come along. I'd want an echocardiogram to determine what my ejection fraction was, which is a measurement of pumping efficiency of the heart. And then I'd want to get out of there and not be talked into anything more, because I don't think it would really benefit me very much. They've already shown that if the pumping efficiency is good, then the death rate in the following years is going to be very low.
Now, what about if the pumping efficiency is poor?
They've found that doing the bypass doesn't improve it.
Well, now, of course, would this be related to an aortic stenosis, or why would it be poor? Would it simply a heart that is not working very
well? No, it's strictly heart muscle weakness, or the heart muscles have an infarct in it that's pretty big, and it just can't pump very strongly.
Well, how about if you have aortic stenosis? Does that actually cut down on the efficiency of the myocardial output?
I think the myocardium usually works harder and gets bigger, and that's something you need surgery for.
For an aortic stenosis?
Aortic stenosis.
Yeah. All right, fine. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience, our guest this evening is Dr. Charles McGee, and he's written a book on heart frauds. And, of course, he thinks that perhaps there's too much cardiac surgery being done. And, of course, I really believe that the doctors honestly believe that they're going to be helping. I know that there certainly are studies that would suggest that that this is you'd do just as well in many instances if you didn't have it done. But, can we say in any specific instance that the patient would do just as well? Or was this just an overall statistical analysis?
Well, these are overall statistical analyses of studies of 800 or 900 people in a group. And they're the only big studies that were ever done. I haven't found, and if anybody has them out there, I'd love to hear about them, but I haven't heard of any studies that showed anything different than what I've discussed.
And so what you're really saying is that the largest scientific studies show that if you have it done or you don't have it done, your outlook is pretty much about the same, unless, of course, you have intractable angina.
Yeah, and there you're just trying to get rid of a symptom. That doesn't have anything to do with how long you're going to live.
Okay, well, of course, what the sort of response you get as you talk about this, across the country, and, of course, I know you're doing radio interviews on your book, and we'll be back to this in just a moment here. And, of course, if you have a question or comment, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And then, of course, I want to get into whether or not you think that changing the diet is so important. I know that most people have had a coronary bypass. They get them off of all the good things and all the fats and oils, and they really markedly restrict what they can have as far as the diet. How important that is preventing a recurrence of a coronary disease, or perhaps getting the coronary disease to resolve. We'll be back here in just a moment with Dr. Charles McGee, and welcome your calls out across America, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course we have Dr. McGee here with us. And if he has a much different approach to, you know, what's going on cardiac-wise than the I'd say that the average doctor does. But then, of course, sometimes we sort of get into routine. This is the way things are done. Everybody's doing it. And it doesn't necessarily always mean that that's the best thing for the patient. So what sort of response are you getting with your message you're putting out?
I think people that listen to shows that I've been on are not doctors, and so we haven't had much fight from the other side. I'm sure people would disagree very strongly with this, you know, depending upon their background.
Okay, well, we've got Joe calling in from Santa Cruz. Hi, Joe. How you doing?
I'm doing good. I just had a question for him on, if the, what's the procedure he was talking about?
Well, he's talking about a coronary bypass. There are two, basically. You do a coronary bypass, or, of course, you can do an angiogram, and then, of course, the vessel is blocked. Or you can put a stent in, some sort of a little expandable metal object that will actually expand the artery and keep it patent. So go ahead. What's the question?
Yeah, the other procedure he was talking about with the drip. Or the one manipulation.
You're talking about chelation.
Chelation. I'm sorry. Yes, I was wondering if that would have any effect on a heart-lung patient with idiopathic hypertrophic subaortic stenosis.
I've never heard of it being applied on that.
I think that's an entirely different subject. The chelation is really for people atherosclerotic plaques.
Artery disease. Oh, okay. I see. So that would just be the hardening of the arteries there.
Right.
They don't really know how it works anyway. They just discovered it accidentally by treating lead patients, and some of them had angina, and the angina went away, and that was in the 50s.
So I
discovered accidentally that it might benefit arteries.
Okay. Well, sorry to waste your time.
Okay, fine. Thanks so much for calling, Joe. Well, what about the diet? What does diet should people really be on if they do have a coronary artery disease and they are having episodes of angina, and of course they're talking about, you know, maybe they've had an angiogram and they have a couple of partly blocked arteries. Do you suggest they get on a specific diet, and if so, what sort of diet?
I don't push any particular diet. I think the main effort on the diet is that it be fresh and a lot of it raw. Don't overcook anything, and for goodness sake, stay off all this processed and refined food. That means you can't buy ice cream or candy or soda pop or things like that. All these things that never used to be in our diet. Most people have no idea of a diet history of what we've been through as a human race.
Okay, hold that thought for just a moment as we bring our stations back on board here. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course our guest this evening is Dr. Charles McGee. And if you're out there in the listening audience and you have a question or comment, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And Dr. McGee, of course, has what some people would feel would be quite heretical beliefs as far as the coronary artery bypass and the coronary artery stents are concerned. On the other hand, he certainly has scientific studies to back up what he's saying. Large studies from large centers that have basically challenged whether or not all the surgery is really necessary. Would that be a fair statement?
Yes, very much so. And I would like to get into an idea I'd like to try out on you.
All right, go right ahead.
And this is that there are reasons to believe that surgical procedures on the heart are being done on arteries that are not involved in the acute problem. For example, we have we had a lot of land up here, and we were growing hay, and we were loading hay on some guy's truck, and he was a 45-year-old thin ex-Marine, and he collapsed and died from the exertion. They did an autopsy on him, and the coroner said, well, his arteries were real tiny. But he didn't describe. He did not describe any dead heart muscle. He didn't describe any clots that were actually blocking arteries. And those changes occur very slowly over a long period of time. So I would guess he died an electrical death. But
what you're suggesting is that he had a cardiac arrhythmia.
He probably developed I think he had ventricular tachycardia at the end of it with an arrhythmia, and it beat so fast you can't pump blood, and so you die.
Well, those are the patients, of course, that if you can get them resuscitated and get them stimulated, you can actually convert them back to a regular rhythm.
Yeah, that's what they use the shock paddles for, and all all the TV shows.
Right.
Everybody knows about them. Now they're going to be on airplanes and everywhere else.
Right.
Basketball courts.
Okay.
But first of all, there are large arteries in the heart that show up on angiograms, and but there are a whole lot of small arteries that don't show up on angiograms at all. Clots blocking a large artery often cause sudden death, like dropping dead in the streets. And so these people don't make it to the hospital to be candidates for any of these surgical procedures. But most of the people that have a heart attack and make it to the hospital probably had a clot blocking an artery in a small artery and not one of these big ones. So then the surgeons come in and they concentrate on the large arteries and do procedures on those arteries that they can get to that are blocked more than 50% or more. And that's sort of their criteria. And that's according to this angiogram. It isn't very accurate, usually. Because most heart attacks occur because of clot formation in small arteries, only small numbers of heart muscle cells die in the heart attack, and the pumping efficiency stays strong. And that's the reason why survival is so good with the medical management and why the bypass accomplishes very little except in the case of persistent angina. And I've never heard anybody else express it that way, exactly that way, but I think I've come around to thinking that's what's going on.
Well, you may very well be right. I've never even thought about it. So let's go to Mary, who's calling in here from Covina. And, of course, our telephone number again, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Hi, Mary. How are you doing?
Hi, I'm fine. I'd like to ask the doctor what he thinks of hawthorn, the herb hawthorn extract for the heart to strengthen the heart.
Yeah. I never got into herbs very much. It was just too overwhelming. There are just so many out there. I think I took hawthorn myself a little bit for a while, but I can't really relate any knowledge of studies on it that show what it can do. I know it's used for heart problems.
You know, there's some people who really are very, very expert on the use of herbs, and, you know, they're really based upon purely this serendipity in China. They've had so many people, and they've tried so many things over such a long period of time. Eventually, they hit on some pretty good techniques, and, of course, that's where Chinese medicine comes from. And, of course, they are great into herbs, and I really believe that a lot of herbs have a great deal of benefit for people. But you got to have somebody who really knows what they're doing. And there are some people, experts in Chinese medicine, who really have studied this. But, I don't think you're talking to either one of them tonight, Mary.
No.
Well, it sounds like he didn't have any improvement from it.
Who?
The doctor.
You. Well, you said you took it for a while.
Oh, I was just... A lot of my patients were into herbs and stuff like that, and they said, oh, if you have heart disease runs in your family, you got to be on this, you know, so
take
this and you'll feel better. And I was usually in good enough health that anything someone suggested that I try, I could never feel any difference.
Okay.
Except when I actually got rid of all the junk food in our kitchen and started exercising and riding a bicycle and not eating junk anymore.
Okay, well, thanks.
Vitamins, and that made a tremendous experience, but it took 2 weeks for it to happen. I woke up one morning an hour ahead of the alarm. I said, I have things to do. I'm not going to waste time lying in bed. and then all of a sudden I discovered I had a photographic memory I never knew I had before.
Wow.
And I could read and retain everything. And it was just a dramatic changeover.
Now, what was the dramatic, what brought this about?
Well, I was reading a bunch of books on nutrition and good health habits and all that. And I was gaining weight, and I slipped my pants, like I mentioned earlier, getting in the car. And so I thought, well, I've got to take the bull by the horns here. So I talked it over with my wife, and the kids were too small to protest at that time. We brought a garbage can into the kitchen and threw away everything in a can or a box or package or ice cream or anything like that, and took it out for the garbage and replaced it with fresh stuff and unprocessed food. Went on a vitamin regime, and I started riding a bicycle every day. And then nothing happened for 2 weeks. And I was still waiting for it to see if there was going to be a change. And all of a sudden, one morning, it hit me, and there was.
Okay, fine. I guess he's been changed ever since. And anything else, Mary?
Well, I guess so then he does eat meat, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think one of the things on the diet is that there is such a thing as a metabolic diet. That is means the ideal mixture of fruits and vegetables and meats and whatever for each of us. And the problem is that you have to sort of figure out how to determine this for yourself. There's some ways that people have done it in the past in alternative medicine area, and Well, for example, you might know if your family history leads you back to a certain part of the Europe or something, and those people ate a certain way, then you might have a genetic profile to handle food that has that mixture, and you'd be better off on that. And it doesn't matter if it's low fat or high fat or whatever. This cholesterol thing I discovered was pretty much a fraud.
You don't agree with the limits that have been placed on cholesterol as we keep dropping the normal level lower and lower and lower to get more people on the statin?
Yeah, I think that's a promotion to sell drugs.
Well, I think it is really too, and I'm really very, very much against so much of what's going on today. Well, anyway, thank you so very much, Mary, unless you have something else you want to ask.
Yeah, I would like to ask, and since he mentioned something made me think about blood pressure. No one's ever told me about the lower number. I heard you say, Dr. Stan, that when you got out of medical school, it was your age plus 100.
No, well, that was the old way it used to be. Now, that was for the systolic blood pressure. It was, you know, of course, you have the two blood pressures, your systolic and your diastolic. Your diastolic, you like to keep 80 to 90. You know, if it gets over that, you begin to worry about it. Your systolic, you know, used to be 120 over 80. That was a normal blood pressure. And then as you got older, they said it was your age plus 100. So if you were 60, why, it would be 160 over 80 to 90. So, and then, of course, now they've said, oh, no, everybody's got to be down to 120 over 80. Or, you know, we've just got to get your blood pressure down. You're going to die. I'm just a little bit worried, having looked at those studies, that we may be actually laying ourselves open for some real problems as we begin dropping the blood pressure on people who've had a systolic, as I have, of 150 to 160 for 50 years. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on that, Dr. McGee?
Well, I sort of go along with what you're saying. I agree with that.
Okay, fine. Well, okay. Thanks very much for calling, Mary.
Okay, thank you.
Let's go to Roger, who's calling from Henderson, Nevada. Hi, Roger. How are you doing?
Doing just fine, Dr. Stan, and hello, Dr. McGee.
Hi.
Yes, I was having heart problems last year, and what I did is I started changing my diet. I took different vitamin pills, and no longer I have any heart problems. I started taking garlic pills, mm-hmm. and I started taking B12. I just started taking that just a while, and also started taking that bear baby aspirin, and also I take a lot of vitamin C. And all that helps out. I just had like a lack of different type of vitamins, but I no longer have the chest pains in my left side of my heart anymore.
All right. Well, now, did you change your diet at all?
I changed my diet and I started taking better vitamins. I take a lot of vitamins daily.
Well, did you get off a lot of fats and ice creams and things like that and butter?
Yes, I did, Dr. Stan. I did get off a lot of fats. I started watching what I eat. Yes, I did.
What would you say? What would you say to Roger, Dr. McGee?
Well, if he found something that worked, then that's fine. That's great.
Now, let me ask you another question. Is fish oil, is that pretty good? Does that help out cardiovascular?
I didn't hear the question.
I think he's asking if fish oils are helpful.
Oh, fish oils. Yeah, they play a role in everything. They feed into the essential fatty acid pathways and prostaglandin hormone regulation systems and a whole bunch of stuff you don't want to hear about.
But the fish oils really are very important, I believe.
They're very good, yeah.
Right. Okay, anything else, Roger?
No. Also, you asked answered a question on the about blood pressure on the left. I guess, you know, monitor of mine, I keep my blood pressure regulated too. You know, and I think by taking my vitamins daily, and I think that's pretty much the secret. You know, keeping healthy hearts.
Right, I certainly agree with that. Okay, anything else you wanted to say, Roger?
Oh, no, a very interesting program, and God bless, and happy New Year to you, Dr.
And you too, Roger. Thank you so very much, and I want you to get everybody down there in Henderson listening to our program, will you?
I sure will.
God bless. Bye-bye.
God bless. I'd like to add one thing to that.
Go right ahead.
There was a fellow, I can't remember his name right now, the British doctor that went to practice medicine in Kenya in 1930, and the British were just beginning to develop things there. And he went out in the bush and treated, I think, Bantu natives or something for 30 years. When he first got there, he checked them all over. And
This wasn't Burkitt, was it?
No.
Okay, go ahead.
I don't remember his name. And he checked them with the simple things he could do, you know, like the dipstick urine for sugar in the urine, and take a blood pressure and examine people and see if they had a stroke and do an EKG on them and see if they had any evidence of coronary artery disease and things like that. He didn't find any of these things there at all. And There was no high blood pressure. But over the 30 years, the people that he was seeing began to develop high blood pressure, and it became very common. And when he retired, he went back to England with this idea that it had something to do with the salt intake, the sodium and the potassium balance. He wasn't in anything beyond that, into nutrition, like trace minerals and all that, and magnesium. But he did an experiment in with 15 nurses in the hospital where he was in England, and he asked these people to go on a diet that was similar to what these people ate in the 1930s, before the food began to change during that time period. And there were 15 people on blood pressure medication, and he got 9 of them off just by changing the diet for 3 months.
Right, and that was just getting away from salt, or what?
Well, it was getting away from processed food.
Okay, fine, processed food. Well, let's
back
go
to
Troy.
Processed food.
Okay, let's go to Troy, who's calling us from Texas. Hi, Troy, how are you doing?
Hi, pretty good.
What part of Texas are you in?
I'm in Houston.
Okay, fine. Do you have a question for our guest?
Yes, sir, I do. I was wanting to ask you all a question. I've been having some really weird things going on in my heart. For instance, well, it's really the same thing, but it hasn't happened for like a year. But every now and then, like if I would like bend over, or if I would take like a really deep breath, then it would feel like something was clogged in my chest, and my heart would start to beat really rapidly and really hard. And I could feel put my hand on my chest, I could feel my heart actually, you know, pound in my chest way harder than what it normally does. You have any idea what that would be?
How fast was it going? Did he count it?
No, I didn't count it. It was freaking me out. And then, after it did it, I would eventually have to lay down on my back on the floor and take a deep breath. And then after like 2 or 3 breaths, I could feel like the clog break free, and it would burn in my chest for a second, and then my heart would start beating normal. You ever heard of that?
No, but it sounds like if you can provoke it by a change in body position, it's something that would be interesting to have you do it in the office of a cardiologist.
Probably, you know, if you're really having problems, Troy, you probably ought to get to and get an EKG done, yeah, and make sure there's nothing going on there. Sometimes people will tend to have palpitations. Sometimes people even have tachycardias, and sometimes they're deficient in magnesium. And you need a good magnesium for a level for your good heart function. But you really probably ought to see a cardiologist and at least get an EKG, don't you think, Dr. McGee?
Well, yes, that's what I meant.
Right.
Go to a cardiologist and get hooked up to an EKG and then do this physical maneuvering that provokes it and see what they find.
Okay, well, yeah, like I was saying, it's probably been about 6 months or a little over since it happened, but it really scared me. I mean, I thought I was having like a mild heart attack or something. I mean, I didn't know, but everything's been okay since.
Okay, do you drink a lot of Diet Coke and things like that?
I drink a lot of Coke, but not Diet Coke.
Not Diet Coke, yeah.
And I'm a smoker, too.
Well, you got 2 strikes against you.
Yeah, I know.
You have to work on there.
I know. Let me ask you this off of that subject. I plan on going to a doctor to get that looked at. But let me ask you this. Every now and then, it seems like I have like an irregular heartbeat. Like sometimes it'll beat not a consistent interval every beat. Is there any symptoms or some kind of case that might cause or anything? Or
how old are you?
I'm 25.
Is it like it's a regular heartbeat, and you drop a beat, and then some more regular, and then drop a beat? Or?
Well, say I'll get 4 or 5 heartbeats, and they'll be consistent, and then I'll get 2 or 3 that are just, you know, not consistent at all, but not in the same interval as the last one.
You couldn't put them in the same click, 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 click.
Right, right. They're different. Right.
They're different.
Right.
Well, you need an EKG to tell what's going on, really.
You really do, and so I'd certainly, you're too young to play with that. Get down and get that checked out.
Okay.
Okay?
I plan on doing that. Thanks, guys.
A lot of things to do that, but they're using older people.
Sure. And, of course, but it shows some sort of hyper-irritability of the heart, and you've got some sort of ectopic center kicking in there. And, you know, when you get at my age, why, you don't worry so much about it, you sort of expect that, but enough when you're 25 years old. Okay,
yeah.
I guess Troy is gone, and we've got somebody else on the line that'll probably be here in just a moment or two. But, you know, they're really, of course, pretty hard to give a professional opinion just over the telephone. What about the Pritikin diet? I notice you've got a section in here on the Pritikin diet, Pritikin program.
Well, yeah, that was one of the first diets that seemed to make a difference, and it was in Southern California with a layman engineer named Pritikin. and he would put people in a facility. I think he started off in Santa Barbara, and put them on this diet, which is very strictly vegetarian, but no junk food, no refined carbohydrates. So sort of back to where we're at, a vegetarian diet and no processed food, and they got better.
And, of course, that was really very popular a few years ago, and I really think that changing a diet really can alter the status of your arteries, and we've actually, I know, in animal studies where they were actually able to show that if you would simply get those animals off of, you know, off of processed foods or processed animal food, or and just get them back to a very, very strict low-fat diet, why many times these atherosclerotic plaques would go away. We'll be back here in just a moment here.
Okay, got a story for you then.
Okay. Well, our guest is Dr. Charles McGee. Do you want to go ahead and tell us a story?
Yeah, because I used to be a believer in the cholesterol theory until Linus Pauling talked me out of it. Said that if you're adequately nourished and everything you needed, then your cholesterol thing will take care of itself. But when I was up here in Idaho, in the early 80s, some fella came in and he was working in a primate center where they do experiments on chimpanzees and monkeys and things like that. And we were talking about the cholesterol theory, and he said, "Oh, I got to tell you what we did. We had this baboon that had a horrible personality, and everybody hated him. And we were trying to figure out a way to get rid of him. So somebody said, well, why don't we put him on a high-fat, high-cholesterol diet for a year, and then put him down to an autopsy on him and confirm the cholesterol theory and show that his arteries are all plugged up." So they said, fine. They put him on a diet of nothing but hard-boiled eggs and water for 12 months. And that was all the baboon got. And at the end of the 12 months, they sacrificed him, opened up his heart, looked at his arteries, and they're slick as could be. And ruined the whole idea.
Well, let's go to Jeff, who's calling. Here's Jeff from Michigan. Hi, Jeff. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
Do you have a question or comment?
Well, I wanted to ask Dr. McGee if he's ever heard of a World Research Foundation which published an article regarding the theory of heart disease. They pretty much shot it all to pieces. And they said, essentially, it's an acidosis effect that builds up in the heart tissue. And then they went on to identify a West African plant called G. strophanthus, which totally nullifies a MI and prevents it, and they use it at the first sign of angina, and they've had virtually no fatalities.
All right, are you acquainted at all with that?
Well, I'm familiar with some regimes to try to change the pH of tissues in the body, and there is a famous one in Spokane for this region up here, where a biochemist developed this, and he would take a Chem 24 panel. Maybe all the terms are, all the results are normal in the normal column, and he would do ratios in his head, and he would determine if the person was too the chemistry was functioning in a too acidotic or too alkaline state, and then he would recommend a diet shift to correct it. And this happened with the 90-year-old stepfather of a friend of mine, who was in such severe congestive heart failure. His heart filled his chest, and they gave him a few days to live. And his blood work was taken to this biochemist on the outside, and he looked at it and he said, "Aha! He is he's too alkaline. He needs to be more acidotic in his heart, and so he should eat more meat and animal products and cut down on the vegetables." And he shifted his diet that way, and he went on that diet, and everything went away.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. We're out of time. Hey, thanks so much for calling, Jeff. And of course, Dr. McGee, I want to thank you so much for being with us.
I just have to squeeze in. He recovered. His heart went back to normal. He got off his medicine. He lived another 10 years.
Okay. Anyway, God bless you. Thanks very much for being with us. It's been a fascinating hour. Appreciate you taking the time to be with us. Oh, want to tell our listeners how they can get copies of your book.
I don't have the number. It's Piccadilly Press. They have
okay.
a website.
Is it available on Amazon and other places?
Yeah.
All right.
On Amazon, too.
All right, fine. You get it at Amazon. You go to your local bookstore and say, order me a copy of Heart Frauds, Uncovering the Biggest Health Scam in History by Charles T. McGee. Thanks very much.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Well, the little different program this evening, but I thought I'd like to share Dr. McGee's insight with you. And, of course, this is the time when I need to remind all of our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we're really dependent upon those of you who listen to our program, who believe in what we're doing, would like to help and get involved. So if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927 or 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. If you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, shame on you. You need to get that book. You need to read it. You need to understand what's really going on and how all of these various forces at work have a common goal, whether it would be communism, whether it be socialism, whether it be humanism, whether it be the Council on Foreign Relations, Bilderberger, Trilateral Commission, Club of Rome complex, whether it be the Masons. They all want a new world order. They all want a new world religion. And, of course, the same is true for the New Age and for the Theosophists and the Rosicrucians and all of the myriad skull and bone society. They all have this globalist dream. And until we understand that, we really can't understand much of what's going on today. And then, of course, I want to mention that Radio Liberty does carry the Berkey products, the Big Berkey and the Berkey Light. If you'd like to know more about them, you give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. If you're interested in the Miracle 2 soap products or the Sanjian radios or the Robinson Homeschool curriculum that we carry, we think these are all products. They help us to stay on the air. But we hope that many of you out there will give serious consideration to perhaps getting our video. It's entitled The Iraq, the Untold Story. It will give you the background of why we're in Iraq today from a geopolitical point of view, and you can get that with or without the syllabus. We are also, of course, encouraged people to get the new series by Chris Pinto. It's called Megiddo. Megiddo Part 1, The March to Armageddon, which gives you the overview of the plan for the First World War, the Second World War, and the Third World War, which we've already undertaken, but they haven't told the American people that, because you're supposed to believe why we went into the Middle East to get rid of the wicked Saddam Hussein, or was it we went in there to fight terrorism, or was it we went in there to depose Saddam Hussein, or did it have something to do with Osama bin Laden and the attack on November 11th, or none of those things are true. We went into Iraq because we'd always planned to go into Iraq, and we needed an excuse to go into Iraq. And September 11th just happened to provide that excuse with the death of 3,000 Americans. So you need to get our video and the syllabus, Iraq, the Untold Story. And then, of course, you need to get the Megiddo Part 1. And Megiddo Part 2 will give you the overview, very, very professionally done, three-hour video that will help you to understand the occult forces, where the mediums, where the occult forces that exist in our society fit into this. And if you haven't seen the videos, they sold their souls for rock and roll, the three-hour, the four-hour, the ten-hour version. You really need to give us a call and get that. If you'd like a free copy of our newsletter on fluoride, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And then please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and ministers. But please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Tell your friends to listen to our programs until tomorrow at the same time. May the Lord be with you.